From Settlement to Superpower, Introduction, Episode 6, I See and I Am Silent. So hello everybody and welcome back. I'm Abraham Ash, and this is From Settlement to Superpower. Now before we begin, I'd like to apologize for the length of time it took for me to put out this episode. I promise you it was not of my own volition. I was extremely sick during this past week, and even had I been able to get the energy to write the podcast, I still would have not been able to deliver it. After all, I had absolutely no voice. So, you have my apology and my assurance that it will not happen again. Okay. Now, in these next two episodes, and these two episodes are going to be the last two episodes of our introductory series, we're going to tear through the reign of Queen Elizabeth I. Or rather, we're going to take a high-speed tour through the two most important theaters of Queen Elizabeth's dramatic and eventful rule. These two theaters of action I'm referring to are Elizabeth's persecution of the English Catholics and the Anglo-Spanish Wars, both in Ireland and on the high seas. Of course, these two stories are intimately linked, and neither can be discussed independently of the other. Being as that's the case, what we're going to do here is shift back and forth between the internal persecution of the Catholics in general, and the Jesuits in particular, and the external menace of the Spanish. We're not going to get into Raleigh's adventures in the New World just yet, as I hope to give that somewhat fuller treatment when we get ahead to the actual body of the podcast. We left off last episode with the simultaneous deaths of Queen Mary and Cardinal Reginald Pole, and with them, the death of Catholic England. It was clear to all, both in England and abroad, that, left to their own devices, the recalcitrant English would never again return to Catholicism. If they were ever to be reconciled with the Catholic Church, it would need to be through a foreign invasion. This episode, we're going to broadly cover Elizabeth's early reign, and the outbreak of war with Spain. Elizabeth herself, unlike her predecessors, doesn't seem to have cared all that much about the abstruse theological problems which were roiling 16th century Christendom. Elizabeth had had a difficult and dangerous youth, and the only reason she survived Mary's purges was because she knew how to keep her mouth shut and dissemble so that nobody actually knew what she really believed. Her personal motto was Video et Taceo, or I see and I am silent, and Elizabeth lived this motto to the T, particularly in all matters pertaining to theology. All matters pertaining to theology, that is, except for her father's act of supremacy. As you'll recall, the legitimacy of Henry's annulment of his marriage to Catherine of Aragon, and by extension, the legitimacy of his second marriage to Anne Boleyn, was predicated entirely on Henry's independence from the church in Rome. According to the Catholic Church, Henry's marriage to Catherine had never been annulled, and what that meant was that in the eyes of the church, Henry's subsequent marriage to Anne was meaningless, and what that meant was that their daughter Elizabeth was a bastard. In other words, the question of papal supremacy was not merely an abstract theological or even religious question, but rather a political question, and a political question of the utmost immediacy, upon which rested the legitimacy of Elizabeth's claim to the throne. It came as no surprise to anybody, then, that shortly following her accession in January of 1559, Elizabeth had Parliament re-establish a sovereign Church of England. This Parliament passed a number of notable acts, which would come to be known as the Elizabethan Settlement, and which would seek to chart a middle course between the Catholic and Protestant doctrines. Elizabeth's attitude towards her settlement was something like Constantine the Great's attitude towards his Council of Nicaea, which was ultimately that she was a pragmatist in matters of religion, and she had no intention of allowing the already tenuous stability of her realm get derailed by policies of religious extremism. All Elizabeth demanded in religious affairs was that her own legitimacy be recognized, and that the people of England confirm, at least outwardly, to the same church, whatever their personal doctrines may be. As far as that was concerned, she didn't really care. In this respect, and indeed in most respects, Elizabeth was more like her father, Henry VIII, than were either of her royal siblings, Edward or Mary. During their reigns, they strove to appeal to a fringe and fanatical base, and to bully everybody else into submission. As we have seen, though, that approach clearly hasn't worked, and so Elizabeth would chart a different course. She wouldn't appeal to a base on the fringes and then coerce those in the middle and on the other side to conform. Rather, she would appeal to the moderates right in the center, and then later would decide to coerce the fringes on both sides, both Catholic and Protestant, to accept her settlement. As we all know, that approach ultimately worked, although at times it would seem perilously close to failure. And so Parliament got to work. They passed three major acts through the year of 1559, which would become in time the basis of the Anglican Church. These three acts were, in chronological order, the Reformation Bill, the Act of Supremacy, and the Act of Uniformity. The Reformation Bill was a point of contention between the House of Commons and the House of Lords, with the Commons favoring a radical Protestantism, which would explicitly deny the doctrine of transubstantiation, permit priests to marry, forbid the wearing of liturgical vestments, ban all images, restore the 1552 Book of Common Prayer, and declare Elizabeth the supreme head of the Church of England. Now that was obviously quite a bit, and the more conservative lords would not accept such a radical agenda, and they watered down a great many of its key components. The doctrine of transubstantiation, for example, was not to be clearly excluded by the liturgy. The vestments were retained, and Elizabeth was not granted the title of supreme head of the Church of England, but would rather be granted the tamer title of supreme governor of the Church of England. Now, it's important to note in the case of Elizabeth's title that unlike the other doctrinal changes which were opposed on grounds of orthodoxy, the Lord's refusal to grant Elizabeth the title of supreme head was not the result of any sort of pro-Catholic conservatism. It was, straight and simple, 16th century misogyny. The Lords also removed the Black Rubric, which was a declaration included in the 1552 prayer book, which declared that the congregation knelt while taking communion not because they believed in the real presence, but merely as a symbol of their appreciation for God's mercy. By this removal, they allowed the individual to consider the issue of the real presence however that individual liked, and thus removed a potential flashpoint for future conflict. So that was the Reformation Bill. However, the backbone of the Elizabethan settlement were two other acts, the Act of Supremacy and the Act of Uniformity. Elizabeth's Act of Supremacy was basically a restatement of the Act of Supremacy passed by her father in 1534. The Act declared Elizabeth to be the supreme governor of the Church of England and made it a crime to acknowledge any other head of church or state. Accompanying the Act was the mandatory Oath of Supremacy, in which one swore that he recognized the Queen as the supreme governor. As you'll recall, it was Henry VIII's Oath of Supremacy which sent Bishop John Fisher and Thomas More to the scaffold. And again, Elizabeth's apple did not fall far from Henry's tree. Within 3 years, Elizabeth would have Parliament declare that failure to take this oath would be considered high treason, punishable by death. And finally, we have the Act of Uniformity, which mandated that all Englishmen must conform to the Book of Common Prayer and attend church at least once weekly. Failure to comply would result in fines, which would eventually be made debilitating. All in all, what Elizabeth saw, she got. A reformed church which recognized her supremacy, but which still retained enough of its old Catholic trappings to appeal to the more traditionally minded. Sure, you'd have people on both ends of the spectrum, basically the Puritans and the Catholics, who would refuse to comply with the Acts of Parliament, but Elizabeth was initially inclined to pretty much look the other way. She just wanted a stable and peaceful realm, and initiating persecutions and repressions could only stir up discontent and hurt her popularity. Consequently, she more or less looked the other way, at least until the Catholics, or recusants as they came to be known, began to pose a serious threat to her reign. The decisive turning point for the Queen's relationship with her recusant Catholics came in the years 1569 and 1570, when the traditionally conservative North exploded in rebellion. This rebellion centered around an attempt to depose Elizabeth and replace her with the Catholic Mary Stuart, Queen of the Scots, Elizabeth's cousin and potential heiress. The plan was then for Mary to marry Thomas Howard, the Duke of Norfolk, son of the Surrey and grandson of the Norfolk of King Henry VIII. That's right, folks, we have yet another Howard trying to champion the Catholic cause. And spoiler alert, he won't be any more successful or fortunate than his father and grandfather were. But Norfolk's not a major player here, while Mary is. So let's talk a bit about Mary. Mary Stuart was Elizabeth's first cousin once removed. Her paternal grandmother was Henry VIII's sister. What this meant was that Mary was actually now the closest living relative to Queen Elizabeth. Now, that would usually mean that she'd be the heir, but Henry VIII had written explicitly in his will that the Scottish Stuarts were not to be allowed to inherit the Kingdom of England. But even so, a great many people still saw Mary as Elizabeth's rightful heir. As a matter of fact, the Catholics, who didn't even recognize the legitimacy of Queen Elizabeth, actually considered Mary to be the current legitimate Queen of England. The problem of Mary's claim to the English throne would continue to haunt Elizabeth until long after Mary was dead and buried. Now, Mary's got a really complicated and really interesting background story, but you guessed it, we're not able to go into that too deeply now. We're going to just lay out the barest of outlines here. And by the way, in case you're getting impatient at all this skimming over major historical developments, have no fear. I promise you that we really are almost done with these long and not so thorough introductory episodes. I promise. We really have only one more episode left to go. But anyways, Mary. Back to Mary. Mary's father, King James V of Scotland, died when she was only 6 days old, on the 14th of December 1542. All of his titles and claims passed to her, his sole surviving legitimate child. The young queen underwent an extremely turbulent regency, during which time she was betrothed to the young Prince Francis of France, was shipped out to France where she remained for the next 13 years, married Francis, became the Queen of France, and by her 18th birthday, Mary was a widow. In the interim, Scotland was racked with intrigue, civil war, foreign invasion, and religious turmoil. And when the now adult and still Catholic Mary returned home at 18 years of age, Scotland had gone full-out Presbyterian. Now, we haven't yet really discussed the Presbyterians, nor for that matter, their English cousins, the Puritans. I think that we're going to wait until the sailing of the Mayflower before we give the Puritans the serious attention they really need, and the Presbyterians will be discussed in more detail when they jumpstart the English Civil War with the Bishops' War in 1639. However, even if we aren't yet quite ready to give these radical Protestants the full-length introductions they require, I still do see it as appropriate to give them here a brief introduction. You see, up until now, we've been talking on the podcast all about the Protestants, as though they were a single monolithic denomination with an agreed-upon set of doctrines. That, of course, is not the case, And in fact, the term Protestant is simply a catch-all term used to denote the plethora of Christian denominations which sprang into being following Luther's break with Rome. That said, we can safely oversimplify here and view all the Protestant denominations as belonging either to the Lutheran or Calvinist school of view, so named for their associations with the reformers Martin Luther and John Calvin, respectively. There are a number of theological differences between these two groups, and we will introduce some more of them somewhere down the line, but for now, we're going to focus only on the matter of church organization. You see, the Catholic Church was a strictly hierarchical organization, comprised of a basic threefold hierarchy: deacons, priests, and the highest of all, bishops. The Pope himself, even, is simply the Bishop of Rome. Now, this hierarchy drew a great deal of the more populist or Calvinist wing of Protestantism's ire, and they insisted that the structure of the church ought to be more democratic, or republican at the very least. The more radical among them even favored congregationalism, which was virtually anarchy. The Church of England, however, being as it was from its earliest stages a relatively conservative and monarchical reformation, retained all the traditional hierarchies under the Elizabethan settlement. Now, this didn't please a great many of the returning exiles who had fled England upon the ascension of Queen Mary to the throne, and had in the interim come in contact and been influenced by the more radical Calvinist centers on the continent. These English dissenters came to be known as Puritans. The early Puritans can be roughly divided into three main groups. The first group were those who had conformed to the Church of England, but wished to downplay the sort of high church ceremonies the Elizabethan settlement retained. These people were more like Puritan sympathizers than actual Puritans. The second group of Puritans were those who, whether they conformed to the Church of England or not, believed that the structure of the church should not be episcopal or comprised of a hierarchy of individuals, but rather Presbyterian or comprised of an ascending series of elected councils. Thus, this group retained the hierarchy, but radically reformed it so that the authority rose first of all from the people upwards rather than from the Pope downwards, and secondly, was vested in a conciliar rather than an autocratic form of government. And finally, we have the purest of the Puritan groups, who would come in time to be known as Congregationalists, who completely rejected any sort of hierarchy at all, maintaining that each and every congregation had the right to determine their own form of worship. These sorts of Puritans would come to be the Puritans we all know and love today, whose stoic ethos and grim determination would shape every aspect of New England, and from there, shape a great many of our American institutions. Anyways, when Mary Stuart returned to Scotland, she found that the kingdom had been taken over by the Presbyterians, who were, as we mentioned, that second group of Puritans, or at least the Scottish equivalent of what would have been called in England that second group of Puritans. Either way, the Catholic Mary, quite surprisingly, did nothing at all to stop this Presbyterian takeover. What this indicates to us is that the devious Mary was considering more than just the question of what religion Scotland would profess. Mary was apparently, by tolerating the Presbyterian establishment, setting herself up as a viable candidate to wrest away Protestant England from the then unpopular Queen Elizabeth. In any event, in 1565, she married her cousin, Henry Stuart, Lord Darnley, a prominent English Catholic. Suffice it to say that her marriage to Darnley was not a happy one, and Darnley was a pretty lousy husband. He was rude, he was pompous, he was arrogant, and pretty soon he began to grumble that Mary should grant him the crown matrimonial, which would give him regal privileges on par with the Queen herself, a demand which Mary and her council refused out of hand. After the furious Darnley and his gang of thugs stab David Rizzio, marry secretary, friend, and possibly lover to death in front of her face, their marriage completely fell apart. In 1567, while Mary was very conveniently out riding, an explosion rocked the house where Darnley was staying. Darnley was found dead outside the house. He had apparently survived the explosion, only to be murdered by suffocation in the courtyard. Now all of this seemed fishy enough, but Mary had to go ahead and make this entire affair appear even worse. You see, shortly after the murder, Mary went ahead and married the Earl of Bothwell, who also happened to be the suspected perpetrator of Darnley's assassination. This was way too much for the Protestant nobility, and led by Mary's half-brother, half-illegitimate brother I should add, the Earl of Moray, they rose up in rebellion against Mary and Bothwell, defeating them without even having to fight a battle. Mary was imprisoned in Lochleven Castle and forced to abdicate the Scottish throne in favor of her one-year-old son by Darnley, James VI of Scotland, and later, King James I of England. The infant James was given over to stern Presbyterian tutors in order to ensure that the new king would be raised as a good and pious Presbyterian. Bothwell was forced to flee the country to Denmark, where he was imprisoned for murder and just chained to a pole in the dungeons for 10 years, until he evidently went mad and died. Mary herself managed to escape Lochleven in 1568, and she raised up an army to fight against those perfidious Protestants who had forced her off the throne. But her armies were defeated in battle, and in May 1568, Mary turned up in England seeking Elizabeth's assistance. Elizabeth decided that it was unwise to put a potential thorn in her side back on the throne, even if she was the legitimate Queen of Scotland and a blood relative of Elizabeth's. Instead, she had Mary taken into custody. At first it was merely protective custody, but it soon became pretty clear that this was just a polite form of imprisonment. It's hard to say, however, whether Mary would have been a bigger problem to Elizabeth back on the throne in Scotland or nestled in a castle in England, because Mary was about to become a real pain in the neck. Getting back to our story. In 1569, the Northern and Catholic Earls, the Earls of Westmoreland and Northumberland, began a popular rebellion to depose Elizabeth and install Mary as Queen of England, with Norfolk as her husband. Militarily speaking, this rebellion ended up a complete joke. The rebel army simply deserted and fled over the border to Scotland. But on the diplomatic front, this rebellion was to have a cataclysmic event. You see, the Pope had been watching events from the sidelines very carefully, seeking a moment of opportunity to strike and remove the English crown from the heretic Elizabeth. Well, in this rebellion, he thought he saw opportunity, and he immediately drafted a papal bull called Regnans in Excelsis, excommunicating Elizabeth and releasing her subjects of any fealty they owed her. The bull began by cataloging Elizabeth's many crimes against the Catholic Church, going on to say that, therefore, resting upon the authority of him whose pleasure it was to place us, though unequal to such a burden, upon this supreme justice seat, we do, out of the fullness of our apostolic power, declare the aforesaid Elizabeth to be a heretic and favorer of heretics, and her adherents in the matter aforesaid to have incurred the sentence of excommunication and to be cut off from the unity of the body of Christ. And moreover, we declare her to be deprived of her pretended title to the aforesaid crown, and of all lordship, dignity, and privilege whatsoever. We also declare the nobles, subjects, and people of said realm, and all others who have in any way sworn oaths to her, to be forever absolved from such an oath and from any duty arising from lordship, fealty, and obedience. And we do, by authority of these presents, so absolve them and so deprive the same Elizabeth of her pretended title to the crown, and all of the other above said matters. We charge and command all and singular the nobles, subjects, peoples, and others aforesaid, that they do not dare obey her orders, mandates, and laws. Those who shall act to the contrary, we include in the like sentence of excommunication. Now, this bill would not arrive in England until after the rebellion had already been put down, but even so, this was to be a watershed development. The Pope had effectively thrown down the gauntlet, and had all but commanded the faithful to rise up against Elizabeth, whether by open rebellion as in 1569, or as was more sinisterly clarified 9 years later, by assassination or covert activism. Up until now, Elizabeth had been relatively tolerant of the Catholics remaining in her realm. But this was a game changer, and from here on in, Parliament and the Queen would grow increasingly cross with her Catholic subjects, and after a series of Catholic plots to remove her would come to light, full-scale persecution of the Catholics would erupt. But for the meantime, the only moves Parliament made to check the Catholics was a ban on images and rosaries, and legislation which declared it high treason to receive a papal bull in England. Now, there was also another effect from this papal bull, and that was the Second Desmond Rebellion in Ireland. But we're not going to discuss it in this episode, rather we're going to push it to next episode, when we're going to more generally discuss Elizabeth's military operations in Ireland. So, we'll leave that for next week, but that was another effect of this papal bull. Now, we're going to kind of coast through the next decade of her rule, but suffice it to say that there were two major Catholic initiatives to remove Elizabeth during this period of time: the Ridolfi plot of 1571, and the infiltration of the Jesuits at the end of the decade. What the Ridolfi plot was a misguided attempt by Roberto Ridolfi, a Florentine baker and papal agent, to fund yet another northern rebellion combined with a Spanish invasion from the south. Upon successfully invading England, Philip II of Spain would install Mary as the Queen of England. Mary was, as usual, enthusiastically in on this quixotic plot, as was the Duke of Norfolk, who still sought to marry the shadowy queen from the north. Unfortunately for both of them, however, this plot was uncovered by Elizabeth's spymaster. Norfolk would be beheaded, while Mary, who was still considered a legitimate queen, was placed in even closer confinement and had her every movement observed by Elizabeth's spies. Mary would languish in confinement for yet another 15 years, until her plotting would finally undo her, and she, too, would face the headsman's axe. The other major development which occurred over this decade was the return of undercover English Catholic priests back to England, and their sole mission was to turn the people back to Catholicism, and by extension, that meant to turn the people against the Queen. Their efforts, which were not entirely unsuccessful, particularly up north, were further augmented around 1580 with the arrival of the Jesuits. The Jesuits were the backbone of the Counter-Reformation, the sword and shield of the Catholic Church. Most of these Jesuits were well-connected men, and it was these connections which made them particularly dangerous to Elizabeth. From 1581 onwards, the persecution of the Catholics would steadily intensify, reaching its fever pitch in the years of 1586 through 1588. Throughout Elizabeth's 40-year reign, about as many Catholics would be legally executed as Protestants had been during Mary's 5-year reign. That said, the manner of many of these Catholics' death would be far more hideous and terrifying than anything seen during the reign of Queen Mary. During Mary's reign, those executed were killed on charges of heresy, which carried the awful penalty of burning alive. We saw a glimpse of how horrible that must have been last episode, when we read some accounts from Fox's Acts and Monuments, but believe it or not, the Catholics under Elizabeth suffered even more. You see, under Queen Elizabeth, Catholics weren't executed for heresy. They were executed for high treason. High treason was the worst crime one could possibly commit, and as such, had pretty much the most awful form of execution possible: hanging, drawing, and quartering. I was seriously considering not describing this form of execution, owing to its gruesomeness, but I decided it was only fair to the Catholics to acknowledge the sufferings they endured, just as I have for the Protestants during the reign of Queen Mary. And this brings me to a point I'd like to make. Queen Mary is remembered in English history as Bloody Mary, while Elizabeth is remembered by such names as Good Queen Bess or Gloriana. That being said, it is extremely important to note that this neat characterization of good versus evil, black versus white, Catholic versus Protestant, is extremely flawed, and it clearly reflects the Anglophone bias against Catholicism and for Protestantism. Was Mary guilty of atrocities? Yes, she most definitely was. Were Mary's atrocities outdone by Queen Elizabeth's? Well, I think the answer is yes, and I believe after next episode, when we go through the events which occurred in Ireland during her rule, you will agree as well. Suffice it to say that while both Mary and Elizabeth had their virtues and flaws, Mary was not as awful and Elizabeth was not as amazing as either of them are popularly made out to be. But anyways, back to hanging, drawing, and quartering. The way this sentence would be executed was the condemned man would at first be drawn or dragged through the town while tied to a hurdle, during which time the populace would abuse him as was their wont, throwing trash or dirt in his face. Upon reaching the scaffold, the poor man would be hanged, long enough for him to suffer excruciating agony, but not long enough to kill him. Upon the victim being cut down, the executioner would proceed to slice off his genitalia and then make a cut lengthwise down his midsection, from neck to groin. Through that cut, the executioner would then slowly extract the man's guts and burn them in front of his face. When they were done with that, they would tear out his heart and behead him. After this was done, the dead victim's body would be quartered, or chopped into four pieces, and generally be put on public display. What's worse is that sometimes the executioners would make a point of protracting this repulsive procedure to ensure maximum pain. So yeah, this form of execution is going to be pretty bad for the Catholics. And I think us realizing how awful everybody was to each other at the time will save us from falling into that Bloody Mary versus Gloriana trope. Anyways, let's get back to the events of Elizabeth's reign. In the years 1585 through 1586, two events would occur which would dramatically affect the rest of Elizabeth's reign. The first event was the Treaty of Nonsuch, wherein the English entered an alliance with the Dutch rebels and, by extension, entered an ongoing war between the Dutch and Spain. You see, for decades already, the Protestant Dutch had been rebelling against their Spanish overlords, but it was becoming clear that, in the face of overwhelming Spanish might and wealth, the rebellion would flounder without any foreign aid. Now, there were only two countries from which such aid could reasonably arrive, either England or France. Elizabeth herself definitely had a personal interest that the Dutch not be subdued by the Spanish, and not only because the Protestant Dutch would simply be brothers in faith, but also so that the Spanish would not be able to secure the Dutch coastline and ports which they'd need in order to launch a potential invasion of England. Even so, however, Elizabeth was wary of entering into a costly foreign military adventure, and she had hoped that the French king, Henry III, would take up the mantle of constraining the Spanish. And King Henry would have done it too, if only he'd had the chance. Henry as well viewed the Spanish as his chief geopolitical rival, and was more than happy to assist the Dutch rebels in weakening the Spanish. The problem was that France was embroiled in one of its worst wars ever, the French Wars of Religion. To make matters even worse, King Philip of Spain offered, in 1584, his financial support to the French Catholic League, who were at the time trying to depose Henry III as king. France simply had her hands full, and so the buck passed to England. Elizabeth was reluctant at first, but eventually she agreed, out of necessity, to assist the Dutch in their war against the Spaniards. This war opened up, naturally enough, with an English expedition to the Netherlands, under the command of the Earl of Leicester. Now, we've met with the Earl of Leicester before, only you probably won't recognize him now. You see, when we first met him, he was simply Robert Dudley, son of Northumberland and brother of Guildford Dudley, husband of Lady Jane Grey, and he was leading a force to capture the Princess Mary Tudor. Well, he had managed to survive Queen Mary's rule, including the destruction of his family, and was now something of a court favorite of Queen Elizabeth. And despite some recent strain in their relationship, Elizabeth had granted him command of the expedition. Unfortunately for Leicester and Elizabeth, however, this expedition turned out to be a complete military and political fiasco. Leicester was repeatedly outmaneuvered by the Spanish, and he was not getting along at all with the Dutch. After a series of strategic Dutch positions were taken, Leicester returned to England in disgrace. It was an ignominious beginning, and this was the last time Elizabeth would send an army campaigning on the continent. From here on in, her war would assume the form of privateering expeditions on the Spanish main, sea battles, daring commando raids, and an extremely bloody rebellion in Ireland. The other major event to occur in this year was the uncovering of the Babington Plot, which was a Catholic plot to assassinate Elizabeth and replace her with Mary Stuart. This plot was masterminded by the Jesuits and was personally endorsed by Mary, Queen of the Scots. When this plot was discovered, it was the final straw. Elizabeth realized that her throne could not be safe so long as Mary was alive, and so very reluctantly, and reportedly with tears, she ordered Mary's execution. Now, she later claimed that she didn't really want her orders carried out and all other such excuses, but the fact is that she probably just wanted her advisors to kill Mary and then for her to be able to choose a scapegoat. Whatever happened though, Mary was executed in 1587, and a ferocious new wave of persecutions began against the Catholics of England, who were by now perceived by pretty much the entire country to be nothing more than absolute traitors. Mary's death would be a turning point in Queen Elizabeth's reign, and not for any good reasons. The first thing was, you remember how we mentioned that Mary had a legitimate claim to the English throne because she was Elizabeth's closest surviving relative? And remember how we mentioned that the Catholics actually considered Mary to be the Queen of England because they considered Elizabeth to be illegitimate? Well, Mary included a little surprise in her will. She declared that unless her son James recanted his Presbyterianism, which he was being raised with, and would embrace Catholicism, her titles would transfer not to him, but to King Philip II of Spain. This meant now that England's greatest rival had a legitimate, bona fide claim to the English throne, and Philip had every intention of invading England and taking the crown he now believed was rightfully his. That's right, ladies and gentlemen. The Spanish Armada is on its way. We'll talk all about that and more next week. And I can't wait to see you then on From Settlement to Superpower.
Bye.